Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
So Matt, last night I was in the kitchen cooking and I cut myself on a block of cheese.
How the hell did you do that?
In my defense, it was sharp cheddar, but you're welcome.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm not bad, man.
Good, good.
Been a pretty decent day, and it I tell you what, for the last few weeks that I've had, this has been a pretty decent one.
Nice, nice.
I'm like, I don't have enough hours in the day.
Mm-hmm.
All the crap I have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's cold for Texas. It's in the 50s here, which is cold for us, because when your summers are 117 degrees,
right,
50 is cold. Mm-hmm. So we're walking around in hoodies and stuff like that. I was able to open the windows today, mm-hmm, while I was working and let it air out. I mean, it was great. So yeah, it's been a pretty good day. Hope you listeners have had a good day as well. Before we get into it, we'll say go check out the Podbelly Network at podbelly.com. You can find a list of shows that we're happy to be associated with, and you can find some tips and tricks on podcasting if you're thinking about doing that. While you're on the internet, you know, looking up last minute holiday gifts or ideas, which hopefully by now you've already figured it out, but I mean, you know, you'll have a week and a few days. Hopefully,
yeah, right,
Amazon shipping will get it to you quick. But anyway, while you're on there doing that, and you can check out our sponsors. This episode, we got MeUndies, and you know how much we love MeUndies. I'm sitting here in mine currently. I mean, I say that, but I'm always wearing them. So, I mean, what can I say?
And look, you know, I mean, if you've got somebody you're close to on your Christmas list that you could reasonably purchase underwear,
mm-hmm,
it is a great gift.
Yep.
And hey, look, if it's for your significant other, get a matching set.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
Ashley and I have a matching set, and we were thinking about taking modeling pictures and sending it in to them and saying, hey, don't you want us as your models for your next campaign? But I don't want to make any of the other models jealous. So that's why we
exactly
haven't done it.
Right.
You know, I don't want them to lose their jobs. I have a job. I don't need, you know. But also, while you're checking out our sponsors, using the codes that we have down in our show notes, on every episode we have an ad. We put the link and our vanity code in the show notes. So go down there, check it out, use it, get you something cool. Also, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales, sign up to become a patron. We've got 3 different levels, $1, $5, and $10. Our $10 a month, not only do they get a bonus show every week, which all of our other tiers get. They also get the video version of that bonus episode, which our $5 gets as well. They get the audio and video ad-free versions of the episode when we have an ad. But our $10 also gets our second show, Side Quest, that we do. And we've been doing some fun ones. I'm enjoying it because it's not, it has nothing to do with Graveyard Tales. It's just me and Matt hanging out, talking trash, and right, talking about dumb stuff. You know, we've got ideas for a bunch of future ones, so we're not running out of stuff. Plus, on there, on SideQuest, you get to hear about, like, all of our personal stuff that we do that's wild, crazy, that we want to tell the other one about. We save it for SideQuest.
That's right.
So you get to hear the other person's initial reactions, get a sneak peek into our personal lives, stuff like that. So go over there, patreon.com/graveyardtales, and sign up to become a patron. I think you will like it.
Yeah, absolutely. So go check it out. It is a lot of fun.
Yep. So Matt, that's all I've got for housekeeping this week. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay. So Adam and I are going to discuss a legend that you may or may not have heard. But you definitely know what this legend put in motion.
Mm-hmm.
In 1924, a group of gold miners were prospecting in an area in Washington State near Mount St. Helens.
Yep.
What they encountered and the story they told is widely recognized as the origin of the Bigfoot legend.
Right. Because it was way before Patterson-Gimlin.
That's right. That's right. So this story would later become known as the Ape Canyon Incident.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, look, if it's true, it is a crazy story, and I think it is every Bigfoot Sasquatch enthusiast's holy grail.
Right. Know? And this was so early in that the term Bigfoot had not been coined yet.
You're right. Yeah.
So you look at old articles from back then, it never mentioned Bigfoot.
Right.
It was mountain devil or mountain ape, mm-hmm, or wild ape. Bigfoot was never mentioned because it was decades later before the Bigfoot name got started. And then, yep, even more years before Patterson-Gimlin. So I remember when I first heard about this, I thought, no, that can't be. And then I started looking into it, and I'm like, that really is a thing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, if you believe it happened, this really is the first, like, modern day telling of Bigfoot legends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a little different. It's a little different than we hear.
Yeah, it is. It is so different that it stands out. I mean, it is the most unique of any Bigfoot story I had, you know, barring the one the guy that lived with them for like 3 days. You know?
Yeah, that was kidnapped and
yeah. You know, yep. He was giving them tobacco and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that one is off the charts. But as far as just a routine Bigfoot encounter, This one is very, very different. It's cool. It's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're going to dig into it and some other things about that area of Washington around Mount St. Helens.
Right. So as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all the information. You can keep going, because there's always something that Matt and I are not going to be able to cover in the episode, either because it's too tangential and doesn't quite fit, or because we just don't want it to run that long.
Yeah.
So go check our sources. There are sources from people who have been to Ape Canyon and done a lot like decades of research on this topic. So go check them out. Bottom of the show notes. Now, Ape Canyon. We got to look into Ape Canyon and Mount St. Helens, seeing as how Ape Canyon is on the side of Mount St. Helens. So we need to look at the area and all that kind of stuff to kind of get an idea of where this takes place and the potentiality of this being a legitimate encounter. Now, Ape Canyon is a gorge that sits on the edge of the, quote, Plains of Abraham, that's on the southeast shoulder of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. Now, Ape Canyon has a watershed that partially encompasses the Ape Glacier that's on the side of Mount St. Helens. The highest point of the canyon is a rock formation on the edge of the canyon called Dog's Head, and it sits about 7,700 feet in elevation. Now, it's not the highest point on Mount St. Helens, but it's the highest point in this canyon. So the top of the canyon is Dog's Head. Mm-hmm. Now, the canyon is fairly dry up at higher elevations, but as you go down, you can see water that's seeping out of the rocks. And then the lower you go, you start to see some waterfalls and the river's getting bigger and stuff like that. So it's coming from underground water sources out of the rocks surrounding the canyon and coming out into a river. I mean, the canyon is basically a cut through. I mean, it's like any other canyon. It's been worn away over the centuries.
And now, there's some pretty decent sized lakes right around that area. Isn't that right?
Yeah. And I think so. In that area, there should be some lakes like down at the bottom of Mount St. Helens and all that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty amazing place geographically.
Right. Right. So let's look at Mount St. Helens. Now, the gorge, the Ape Canyon there, it's very wildernessy. You can be out there and it's not like it's going to be touristy and you see a bunch of people. And Mount St. Helens is kind of the same way, and we'll talk about why. You know, there is some tourism and hiking trails around Mount St. Helens, but not as much as you would probably expect. But You know Mount St. Helens because of what we'll talk about in just a second. A very crucial event happened at Mount St. Helens, and I mean, within your lifetime, it was right before I was born.
But I remember it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Mount St. Helens, it sits about 97 miles south of Seattle and 52 miles northeast of Portland, Oregon. And Mount St. Helens is a volcanic peak in the Cascade Range in the southwest part of Washington State. Now, this same mountain range is a mountain range that Mount Shasta is in as well.
Yeah.
And we've talked about Mount Shasta and the weirdness. Now, Mount Shasta is kind of toward the lower end of this range, and Mount St. Helens is closer to the top, but it's still the same mountain range. Now, we all know Mount St. Helens because of its eruption on May 18th, 1980.
Yeah.
So
that, I was a kid. I was in first grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, I mean, it shocked the world. But it was just, that was unheard of, a volcano erupting within the United States
in North America. Yeah. Yep. We don't think about it happening, even though you look at Yellowstone and everything, and it's in a caldera. It's in a volcanic caldera. That's why Yellowstone has all the geologic features that it does. Mm-hmm. The hot springs, the geysers, and all that kind of stuff. And it sits in the caldera of a super volcano. I mean, there's volcanic activity all over the U.S. We just don't have erupting volcanoes. I mean, hot springs in Arkansas. There's some, quote, volcanic activity to create those hot springs. But anyway, getting off topic.
We just started talking about this all night.
Right. It was one of the largest volcanic explosions ever recorded in North America. So there was some previous to that, but this is still, even in 1980, I'm old enough to call this modern day.
Yeah.
You know, right. It's modern day North America, and we just don't think of that happening. Now, it is primarily an explosive dacite volcano with a complex magmatic system. So the volcano was formed during four eruptive stages beginning in 275,000 years ago, and it's been the most active volcano in the Cascade Range during the Holocene period, so prior to about 12,800 years ago. Now, the bulk of the modern edifice, so above the 1980 crater floor, was constructed during the last 3,000 years when the volcano erupted a wide variety of products from summit and flank vents. Since its 1980 eruption, the summit elevation has decreased, which you would expect. It blew its top. Mm-hmm. A survey in 1982 gave a measurement of 2,549.7 meters, so 8,365 feet. However, a LIDAR survey done in 2009 found that the maximum elevation was 8,330 feet. So it's lost about 35 feet over the years. Now, the difference in elevation is likely due to erosion and loss of rim rock by crater wall collapse. So it's so unstable after the eruption that some of that falls away and down into the crater. Now, Mount St. Helens, named by the English navigator George Vancouver for a British ambassador, had been dormant since 1857. An explosive steam eruption on March 27, 1980, was followed by alternating periods of quiescence and minor eruption. So pressure from rising magma within the volcano caused extensive fissures and growth of a bulge on the north flank of the peak. So all of this activity kind of started, you would see it bulge out, the rock and everything was bulging out. Now, on the morning of May 18th, there was an earthquake that registered 5.1 on the Richter scale. So this triggered a landslide on the mountain's north face. This was the largest landslide ever recorded. Which, again, that's crazy to me.
Yeah.
The largest landslide ever to be recorded was Mount St. Helens in 1980. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but it just, like you said, was unheard of at the time. And yeah.
I think you don't think of that, of like a massive landslide of like historical proportions to have occurred in the modern era.
Right.
You know,
right.
This is something that a geologist is telling you happened like, you know, a million years ago or something. And so to hear that, it is kind of shocking when you stop and think about it. You're like, dang, that's recent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, you know, I was, you know, 7 years old, you know, when it, six, 7 years old when it happened. So,
yep. I know. So the north slope fell away in an avalanche, and then there was a lateral air blast, and it carried high velocity cloud of superheated ash and stone outward for about 15 miles from the volcano summit. The blast actually reached temperatures of 660 degrees Fahrenheit and speeds of at least 300 miles an hour. So the avalanche and lateral blast were followed by mud flows, pyroclastic flows, and floods that buried the river valleys around Mount St. Helens in deep layers of mud and debris as far as 17 miles. Now, meanwhile, this says that simultaneously with the blast, a vertical eruption of gas and ash formed a column some 16 miles high that produced ash falls as far east as central Montana.
Good.
So,
yeah.
I mean, some of this is like crazy to me that, you know, central Montana was getting ash fallout from Mount St. Helens in Washington. So there was complete darkness in Spokane, Washington, about 250 miles northeast of the volcano. It completely destroyed an area of 230 square miles in a matter of 5 to 9 minutes. It essentially killed everything within that area.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. A total of 57 people and thousands of animals were killed in the May 18th event.
Yeah.
Well, trees.
I remember they were evacuating people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they felt like this is going to happen and it's going to happen soon. I mean, it wasn't just a 100% shock. I mean, they were getting people out.
Yeah.
And there were people that just were like, I ain't going nowhere. You're crazy. This ain't, you know, I've been here for, you know, however long, you know, this many years, I'm not leaving my home. You know, you're out of your mind if you think this volcano is going to go.
Yeah.
And they paid the price.
There's always those people that won't evacuate. Trees over an area of 200 square miles were blown down by the lateral air blast. Now, at the end of it all, Mount St. Helens' volcanic cone had been completely blasted away. In place of its 9,677-foot peak was this horseshoe-shaped crater that had a rim reaching an elevation of about 8,363 feet. So further eruptions actually continued to occur until 1986. Then a dome of lava grew intermittently in the crater. There was seismic activity that happened between 89 and 91, and some small explosions within that. And then it grew again in 1995 and 1998. Now, in 1982, 172 square miles of land surrounding the volcano was designated Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument. And this was done by the U.S. Forest Service as part of, quote, Gifford Pinchot National Forest. So the monument says it provides a unique opportunity for scientific study of the dynamics of an active composite volcano and for research of how ecosystems respond to cataclysmic disturbances. So talking about the ecosystem responding, you can look at it and see that nature has kind of come back. The plants, the trees, everything's growing back. Now, what animals live in the volcanic zone of Mount St. Helens? There's actually a ton of animals that live there, from tiny little mammals to real large animals. But since we're looking at Ape Canyon for a reason, then I'm going to only highlight the larger animals and the animals that larger animals could feed on.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that I'm not going to go into all the animals, but elk is the most common animal that's caught on game cameras in the area. That's elk have come back plentiful in the area. But there's also deer, coyote, bobcat, American black bear, mountain goat, mountain lion, rainbow trout, gophers, and wolves, just to name a few. And it, like I said, the reason I name those animals is because a few of them could be eaten by large predatory creatures, such as something that would give Ape Canyon its name.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you're looking at Ape Canyon. You think, okay, Is it kind of weird that these big giant things were living in Ape Canyon? It wasn't Ape Canyon then. In fact, it became Ape Canyon because of this story, really. And we're gonna look at this. I managed to find an excerpt from the book that was written by Fred Beck. Okay, Fred Beck was one of the prospectors, and he told his story. And his book is called "I Fought the Ape Men of Mount St. Helens, Washington." So
that's quite a provocative name.
Yeah. So if you're, you know, if you're thinking about this stuff that Adam, you know, is discussing about, you know, the wildlife that was there, the terrain, it does for what we believe we know about Sasquatch, It does fit with where these creatures would live. You know, where they would thrive, where they could go undetected by humans, where they have a natural food source and, you know, ability to stay isolated.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So, a very wild area.
Yeah. So this is the area that we're talking about, you know, but in 1924, you know, there were still a lot of people out there that were finding gold and looking to make their fortune, you know, all the way back from the gold rush. You know, they're still going on. So that was the mindset of these prospectors that went out there. And, you know, they were not expecting what happened. So this is directly from Frank Beck's book. First of all, I wish to give an account of the attack and tell of the famous incident of July 1924 when the, quote, hairy apes attacked our cabin.
The hairy apes. I like that.
We had been prospecting for 6 years in the Mount St. Helens and Lewis River area in southwest Washington. We had, from time to time, come across large tracks by creek beds and springs. In 1924, I and four other miners were working our gold claim, the Vanderwhite. It was 2 miles east of Mount St. Helens near a deep canyon, now named Ape Canyon, which was so named after an account of the incident reached the newspapers. Hank, a great hunter and good woodsman, was always a little apprehensive after seeing the tracks. The tracks were large, and we knew that no known animal could have made them. The largest measured 19 inches long. We had been hearing noises in the evening for about a week. We heard a shrill, peculiar whistling each evening. We would hear it coming from one ridge, and then hear an answering whistling from another ridge. We also heard a sound which I could best describe as a booming, thumping sound, just like something was hitting itself on its chest, like a gorilla, you know.
Right, yeah.
Hank asked me to accompany him to the spring about 100 yards from our cabin to get some water and suggested we take our rifles, just to be on the safe side. We walked to the spring, and then Hank yelled and raised his rifle, and in an instant, I saw it. It was a hairy creature, and he was about 100 yards away, on the other side of a little canyon, standing by a pine tree. It dodged behind the tree and poked its head out from the side of the tree, and at the same time, Hank shot. The creature I judged to have been about 7 feet tall with blackish brown hair. It disappeared from our view for a short time, but then we saw it running fast and upright about 200 yards down the little canyon. So Beck says that the two men headed back to their cabin and told the others about what they had seen. And all the men agreed that it was time to go. You know, it's time to beat feet, guys. That we don't want to mess with whatever's out here.
Right.
But they were concerned because they said they wouldn't get to their vehicle before nightfall. So they became a little bit worried about getting lost in the dark or encountering more of these things.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they decided that they would stay in the cabin overnight and they would leave out in the morning. So the men settled in, but I mean, I can only imagine they're pretty anxious about everything that's happened, especially
that's not a good sleep.
Yeah. Especially Frank Beck and Hank. I mean, you know, they just had the encounter. The other guys are hearing it. And can just picture that. You're out. You've been out here for 6 years. Okay? You've seen some weird stuff. You've heard some weird stuff. And then, you know, your two closest companions come back into your cabin and are going, "We just got attacked by some 7-foot hairy gorilla looking thing. We shot at it and it ran off and we booked it back here."
Your first reaction might be, "Hey, did you make peyote while we were out here?"
That's right. Did you drink that tea that was over there?
Yeah. I told you that went bad like 3 weeks ago.
Right. You know, it's like, the peyote buttons and Frangelico. You remember? but yeah, so and one thing I think is interesting is, of course, when this book was written, there were not a whole bunch of descriptors. As Adam said, the term Bigfoot, Sasquatch, all that stuff would come decades later.
Yeah.
But look at how consistent their description of this, of what they saw is compared to all of the other Bigfoot sightings we see. Okay. Now, a lot of people say, "Oh, well, everybody else is seeing this Bigfoot and describing what these guys saw." But I mean, look, I have read so much about Bigfoot sightings. You know, I've watched the TV shows. You know, I have never heard this story in any of that.
Right.
You know,
right.
Nobody references this story. So I've got to think it is just not one that everybody knows. So they're not referencing this. You know, they're not saying, "Oh, yeah, we saw the same thing that those prospectors saw." It doesn't really seem like that's what they're doing. You know, they're describing things that they saw, you know, all the way up until, you know, the modern day today, you know,
right.
I guarantee you go look right now. There was a Bigfoot sighting. Somebody reported within the last 30 days.
Sure.
You know, at least one.
Go on BFRO. I guarantee you you'll find
one. I mean, they happen all the time. You know, they don't make the news and all that stuff unless, you know, it was, you know, in you know, downtown Boise or something, you know.
Yep.
But they happen all the time.
And like you said, somebody in rural Louisiana or rural Florida is not going to have heard the Ape Canyon story.
Yeah. From a 1924 newspaper article.
Right. And just be able to copy that description.
Right. So, you know, these people over the decades have seen similar things. Mm-hmm. And much, much later in time, you know, we have connected them. You know, this is the same creature that everybody is claiming to have seen. So here these guys are. Obviously scared, you know, probably terrified, but probably excited that we're going to get out of here and get back home. the book describes them as being awoken. I can't imagine that they were getting much sleep.
I wouldn't have been.
But around midnight, their fears were realized. And they were startled by a loud thud against their cabin wall. Also, this is a 1924 cabin. How structurally sound do you think this thing was?
Well, it might be better than ones built now. Well, so I mean,
could be, but something goes hammering against the side of the wall. You got to hope it doesn't bust right through it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, y'all. So the holiday season is officially upon us. And MeUndies, which is mine and Matt's go-to brand for unbelievable comfort, has you covered with everything you need to be your coziest self. They've got lounge pants, hoodies, sweats, and onesies, and MeUndies is so much more than just an underwear brand. Now, since the holidays are here, what could be a better gift for everyone on your list than the gift of comfort from MeUndies? Now, y'all know I love my MeUndies boxers with the ball caddy. They are comfortable. They keep you from sweating. They've got the moisture wicking micromodal fabric. It's amazing, but they also have sweats and lounge pants, which and shorts, which I'm a huge fan of as well. And if you don't want to buy a family member a pair of boxer briefs or some type of ladies' underwear, then go with the lounge pants, the sweats, or the shorts. I promise you, they will love them. They're comfortable, and they have a cut for everyone. They've got over 20 different styles in hundreds of different colors and prints, including their new holiday collection. They've got, like I said, more than just underwear. You can explore the lounge collection featuring joggers, hoodies, onesies, and more. And MeUndies' signature super soft micromodal fabric is breathable, stretchy, and so comfortable. It makes it ideal for all-day wear. They use sustainably sourced materials and work with partners that care for their workers. And if you're not happy with your first pair of undies from MeUndies, guess what? It's on MeUndies. So, knock out all of your holiday gifting needs today with MeUndies. To get exclusive holiday deals and savings all month long, go to MeUndies.com/graveyard, GRAVEYARD, and enter our promo code GRAVEYARD, GRAVEYARD. That's MeUndies.com/graveyard, code GRAVEYARD. MeUndies, comfort from the outside in.
So back to Beck's book. This is continuing the excerpt here. We heard a great commotion outside. It sounded like a great number of feet trampling and rattling over a pile of our unused shakes. We grabbed our guns. By actual count, we only saw three of the creatures together at one time, but it sounded like there were many more.
Huh.
This was the start of the famous attack, of which so much has been written in Washington and Oregon papers throughout the years. It says most accounts tell of giant boulders being hurled against the cabin and say some even fell through the roof, but this was not quite the case. There were very few large rocks around in that area. It's true that many smaller ones were hurled at the cabin, but they did not break through the roof, but hit with a bang and rolled off. So Beck here goes on to say that they only shot at the creatures while they were attacking. But when the rocks would stop flying, the men would quit shooting.
That's good.
And Beck says they were hoping that maybe these beasts would realize that the men were only defending themselves, not attacking. So maybe that would get them to back off a little bit. But then that they realized that at least some of the creatures had crawled on top of the roof of the cabin. Beck writes, "We shot round after round through the roof. we had to brace the Hugh log door with a long pole taken from the bunk bed. The creatures were pushing against it, and the whole door vibrated from the impact. We responded by firing many more rounds through the door. They pushed against the walls of the cabin as if trying to push the cabin over. Hank and I did most of the shooting. The rest of the party crowded to the far end of the cabin, guns in their hands. One had a pistol, which still is in my family's possession. The others clutched their rifles. They seemed stunned and incredulous. The attack continued the remainder of the night with only short intervals in between. The attack ended just before daylight. Just as soon as we were sure it was light enough to see, we came cautiously out of the cabin. It was not long before I saw one of the ape-like creatures standing about 80 yards away near the edge of Ape Canyon. I shot three times, and it toppled over the cliff down into the gorge some 400 feet below. Then Hank said that we should get out of there as soon as possible and not bother to pack supplies or equipment out. He said, after all, he said, it's better to lose them than our lives.
No joke.
He said, we were all only too glad to agree. He said, when we were back home in Kelso, Washington, Hank told some of his friends, and somehow the story leaked out to the papers, and the Great Hairy Ape Hunt of 1924 was on. So right here, Frank Beck kind of, he indicates that they didn't come back going, oh my God, we got to tell you about this. Okay.
Yep.
So
that's what I was about to say. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
It's 1924. You know, everybody is going to be like, are you nuts? They're going to be like Adam said, have you been hitting the peyote a little too hard? You know, y'all just went up there and this was like, you just got drunk, you know, and dreamed all this happened.
Yep. And they wouldn't have been able to profit off of it necessarily, you know, make big paydays. Sure. This Frank guy wrote a book, but that was years later.
The book, I don't know, I can't remember when it was published. I didn't write that down. I should have. But this was well after the fact. The articles had already come out. People had already heard the story, and you know, with some of the information I found said that it hit the newspapers like wildfire. I mean, you know, it spread all throughout Washington and Oregon, and everybody was seeing this story. So his book came out much after this. You know, so you're right. It wasn't like they came back and they immediately, you know, went to the newspaper and said, let me tell you this story. You know, if, you know, you give us a few bucks, you know, we'll tell you the rest of it. It wasn't really like that. And
right.
And I'm not even sure that in 1924 that would have been on anybody's mind anyway, but I, you know, it's possible, but they didn't do this. So in fact, they didn't tell very many people. And Hank,
right,
who was one of the two men that originally encountered these creatures, you know, he was the one probably telling some of his closest companions, you know, listen, you know, let me tell you about this. And how many times have we seen this with like UFOs, ghost stories, that kind of stuff? People are just, they're a little gun shy to start rattling off these tales because they don't want to be labeled as some loony. And especially with, you know, with the way society was, you know, in the early 1900s, I mean, you could quickly become an outcast. You know, you wouldn't be able to get a job. You know, nobody really trusted you. All because you told them about something that happened to you while you were up in the mountains. So, that is what I'm saying. You know, word spread around the Western states pretty quickly, and it really began to take a permanent spot in Pacific Northwest lore. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, people would be like, "Hey, you know, have you heard the old story about, you know, the prospectors that got attacked by all these big apes?" You know, so it was settling in as everybody knew it. Everybody was telling it. So I imagine with anything else, it probably took on a life of its own. And that was partially the reason that Frank Beck wrote the book, was to tell the story, you know, directly from the source and get it right. Because, you know, Frank mentions too that, there were a lot of stories that came out about what had happened there. You know, like you said, large boulders,
crashing through the roof, and
you know, the roof, you know, caving in, or these rocks busting through the roof and everything. And he was like, that it really didn't happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were some other things about him getting hit. You know, he's like, no, it didn't really happen that way. And I think that gives a little bit more credibility to his book, for him to say the most outlandish things you've heard, you know, that they're not true. You know,
yeah, right.
Here's how it really happened.
The craziest part about his telling of it, I thought, was when he actually shot that one at the end of his telling.
Yeah.
You know, and then it fell over into the canyon, because we don't hear ever about somebody who, we hear a lot about them shooting at Bigfoot, but we never hear that they hit him or killed one.
Yeah.
And he's saying that he killed one, but it fell down the gorge.
Yeah.
You know, 400 feet.
Yeah.
So,
and I would even imagine at the, he said he was about 80 yards away from this thing. So even if it hadn't fallen down in the gorge, I don't think they were going to run over there and check on it. For one,
not with the other ones.
What if it's not dead?
Mm-hmm.
And two, we just experienced this attack last night. There's obviously more than a few of them.
Which, see, to me, I wouldn't have even taken that shot. If it wasn't coming at me, I'd have just, all right, there's more of y'all than me.
Yeah.
So y'all are bigger. I'm just going to, we're going to go now.
Yeah.
You can have it back.
I would imagine that shot was strictly out of fear, you know.
Could be.
Like, oh, you know, there's still one here. You know, we're going to shoot at it and we're going to get out.
Yep.
Now, years later, this story, it came, it was reenacted in a movie called Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot. And there's a gentleman who remembers watching this, this movie when he was 8 years old, and it sparked his interest in cryptozoology that as an adult he began
was racing. That gentleman you
no wish this gentleman's name is Mark Mercel is a professional land surveyor and a Sasquatch lore researcher, and he became enamored with this story, you know, after he saw that reenactment. So Mercel says that between 2004 and 2009, he really began to dig into the research of what happened at Ape Canyon all those years ago. I think he read Nick Redfern's book. Okay. And that kind of brought it all back to him, and he was like, "I'm gonna dedicate some serious time to looking into this." So he began to collect, you know, newspaper articles from that time. He spoke to local historical societies, and he was even able to track down descendants of the original miners.
Oh, that's cool.
So one of the descendants he tracked down was Betty Mitchell, and she is the daughter of one of the miners named Leroy Smith. Now, she knew the Ape Canyon story, but had no idea that her father was tied to it. That tells you something else.
Mm-hmm.
This guy didn't even tell this story to his own daughter.
Right, right.
Now, according when this came out, according to Mercer, Leroy Smith said, he was quoted, and he said, he didn't want to have anything to do with what he shot at ever again.
And I can understand.
He said, Leroy said he never wanted to talk about it again, and he was very spooked. I mean, you can imagine.
Yeah. Yep.
So Mercer goes on and says, look, something profound scared these guys off of their claim. They were very adept in the woods, and they had seen and heard almost everything you could possibly see or hear up there. So not only were these miners seasoned woodsmen, but their mine was also pretty lucrative. So according to Mercer, and it reached 75 feet when it was actively being used. I mean, we're talking about six guys,
right?
You know, had many or not, I don't know, but I said that wrong. I don't know exactly how many there were. See, I had six in my head because they had been up there for 6 years. But anyway, they're just, there's not like a whole crew of them with a bunch of heavy equipment. Plus it's 1924. So they had dug this themselves and apparently we're doing pretty well. So to just up and run off from it,
That's not something most people would leave for no reason.
And look, you may get spooked. Something may happen and you leave for a while, but you would go back.
Mm-hmm.
So according to Mercer, none of these guys went back without park rangers. Okay.
Oh, that's wild.
So, you know, they went expecting it to happen again, and they didn't want to go up there and spend any considerable time. So, another miner that was present named Marion Smith said that he didn't care how much gold was in that mine following that attack. You know, he wasn't going back for it. Let's see. Okay. Now, Mark Mercer and some friends set out to try to find the location of the cabin, which had assumed to have been lost. Now, you know, we're talking about, you know, the, you know, late 2000s, early 2010s. Remember, Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. They were like, whatever was up there, we're not going to find it now.
No.
But the Rangers told Mercer that the leeward side of the mountain had been unaffected by the eruption. I don't know how that's possible, but anyway. So he was kind of hopeful. So he used old photographs of the cabin and his own skills as a land surveyor. And the group believes that in 2013, they were able to find the buried foundation of the cabin with metal detectors.
Oh, wow.
They were also able to find leftover nails, a buck saw, baling wire, and bullet casings from a 30-30 rifle. And you think, okay, you know, big deal. The bullet casing is especially important to Mercer's case because it matches the caliber of a gun that one of the miners had while living in the cabin. And Mercer has photographic evidence of the gun's presence at the cabin and stated that the casing was found inside the perimeter of the foundation. Now, you think, okay, big deal. But that would indicate that somebody decided they were going to fire a 30-30 inside.
Right.
Which,
right.
That's not something you're going to do just for kicks, you know. You're going to blast a hole in the side of your cabin. You know, so yeah. The only reason you would shoot a rifle of that caliber indoors is because you're under attack. Mm-hmm. So Mercer feels like the fact that this shell casing was found within the perimeter of the foundation, that indicates that the gun was fired indoors, and it adds some credibility to the prospector's story.
I agree. I mean, it's like you said, that's not something people just do.
Yeah.
They've
got a reason.
Yeah. They would be probably hard pressed to do something like that, especially when you're on your claim, you have built this cabin.
Yep.
And you don't want to start willy-nilly firing your rifle inside this cabin.
Yep. So although a lot of people remain skeptical of the legend, Mercer believes that the existence of the cabin, the stories from the miner's descendants, and the rich Native American folklore regarding Sasquatch in that same area is evidence that the attack really happened. So without any other witnesses, Mercer goes to the Native Americans that were indigenous to that area, and they had a lot of stories and folklore about these type creatures being in that area, the area right around Mount St. Helens. So you take that, and I'm like, you know, we're talking about hundreds of years before this happened, you know?
Yeah.
So you've got these legends, these Native American legends, and you've got these guys' experience. You've got evidence that the cabin was indeed there. Now you've got evidence that, you know, there was a possibility of, you know, a rifle being fired inside that cabin. You put it all together, and Mercer believes that this kind of shows that the story is true, that these guys didn't just make it up. But here is where the story turns from legend to conspiracy theory. Okay. I told you, great legend. We could stop the show right there. And you'd hear me go, so what do you guys think? You think there were a bunch of miners that got attacked by a whole crew of Bigfoots up there?
Right.
Oh, we're going to go a little bit further. And
keep pushing.
This really gets interesting.
I love it. Keep pushing, man. Keep pushing.
If there was a large group of Sasquatch around Mount St. Helens, surely there would be more evidence of their existence. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Any good cynic is going to use the argument, why haven't we found any dead Bigfoots, right? Okay, we've heard that forever. But what if there were Sasquatch bodies found along with the bodies of the human and other wildlife victims of the eruption?
I love this. And you and I kind of talked about it while we were starting this. This, to me, is one of my favorite. You want to call it legends? I love this.
I absolutely
love it.
It gives me cold chills.
Mm-hmm.
So this story begins on May 18th, 1980, when Washington's Mount St. Helens, one of the most beautiful peaks in the Cascade Range, exploded in this catastrophic eruption, killing dozens of people, thousands of animals, and raining destructive rocks, ash, and debris all across the region. After the eruption, a thick flow of ash, mud, and fallen trees choked the rivers and streams and smothered what had once been healthy forest. So we got to go up here, okay? We know there were people up here. You know, there was all these animals up here. We've got to go and assess the damage. Get the victims' bodies out, you know. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the National Guard were called upon to help in the rescue and recovery operation. Now, while these men and women from these organizations worked to recover the bodies, they had bodies of deer, elk, bears, and other animals. It is said that they also came across the bodies of two Sasquatch. And these bodies were set aside, covered with tarps, and guarded by armed men. And mm-hmm. any witnesses were warned to keep quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all the Sasquatch found on Mount St. Helens by the National Guard and the Corps of Engineers were dead. One purported witness states that he and other men were told to follow a very large, hairy, man-like creature with a sad demeanor and a burned arm into the forest. They stopped at several isolated rocky areas with caves, and each time they stopped, the creature would make a strange sound. Sometimes there would be no answering call, while other times a second creature would respond with the same sound. Using this method, the rescuers were able to locate some badly burned Sasquatch who were then brought into the camp for medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
According to this story, at the end of the rescue mission, there was a debriefing during which the witnesses were told that the Bigfoot creatures lived in the forest and just wanted to be left alone. They were asked to keep quiet in order to protect the few creatures that were left. Another supposed participant of the post-eruption rescue mission stated that his Air Force unit was sent to the Mount St. Helens area to help with the devastation. They were issued M16s and green helmets marked guard and were told to protect some of the military's medical tents and prevent unauthorized people from entering the tents.
And you think, if this was just an animal rescue, you'd go, why am I doing this?
I mean,
what am I guarding?
If you're an observer and you see some things like this going on,
mm-hmm.
you're going, what do they need M16s for?
Right.
This is a rescue recovery thing. What
if you're a resident of the area?
What are they taking guns up there for?
Right.
You know?
You're a resident of the area and you're trying to look at your property or something that you came back to and see what, and you see all these guards,
yeah.
Air Force,
look,
armed Air Force and military.
Well,
there.
I mean, look, we're still doing this right now. I mean, we're recording this, you know, there is still tons of devastation in North Carolina from hurricane. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, people have been trapped. People have been isolated. You know, they don't have resources. You know, they're still trying to get the right resources to people, get people out. You know, it's just a madhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And people are up there just trying to help. But anytime you have something like this, there's always bad actors involved. You know,
sure.
There are always people that are looking to try to turn a profit on somebody else's pain and suffering. And yeah, they're not always, you know, the best people. So if you're up there and you're working in those woods and you're looking for people that need help, if you're looking for, you know, other damaged property, you know, you're trying to do the best you can, you're going to carry a sidearm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to protect yourself. I mean, you know, there could be wild animals up there. Okay. You might even carry a shotgun. You don't need an M16.
Right.
I mean, you don't need to be armed like you're going to war. I mean, that's not mm-hmm. what you're going to face. You face some, you know, some loony up there that's, you know, got, he's trying to, he's trying to protect his moonshine still from being uncovered, or, you know, meth lab or something, you know, you don't need all that.
Right.
So what in the world did these guys need that for? And the rescue recovery at Mount St. Helens? You're just like, this looks peculiar.
Something's fishy.
But that same witness said that he saw doctors guiding these, and I love this, unusually tall people or creatures wrapped in overcoats with their heads covered into the medical tent. The injured beings were always covered with clothing and bandages so that their faces and hands could not be seen. It was a mystery to the men what they were guarding. So they weren't even telling these guys with the guns why they're doing this. Adam's right. You know, it's like, what am I protecting up here?
Mm-hmm. And that happens with a lot of military stuff, because you don't have the need to know.
Right.
But we need you to guard this or transport this. You don't have the need to know what it is. You know, and you're like, well, I think if I'm going to be shooting because of this, I might want to know what it is I'm protecting.
Exactly. It says, the guards were told that they were guarding victims of the eruption and not to ask any questions. Don't ask any questions.
So I got to guard them with my M16?
Don't ask, don't tell, you know.
Yeah.
In most versions of this story, the rescuers completed their missions and moved on without ever finding out what happened to the beings involved. Some accounts indicate that the beings were relocated to other parts of the Cascades, while others say the beings were given a home on a military base. Joint Base Lewis McChord, which encompasses over 86,000 acres of mostly forested terrain in the South Puget Sound region. So, you know,
sounds like a good area.
The Army's got, you know, an enormous swath of land, you know, that is considered part of their base. You know, 86,000 acres, we could put these Sasquatch out there. Let them live, and we would never come across them again.
Sasquatch government housing.
So, what exactly happened after this eruption? I mean, there's a lot of stories. I mean, and this does have conspiracy theory written all over it. But there are people that swear by this, that this really happened, and it's like, did they really have burned Sasquatches, you know, up there to giving them medical attention, getting them into tent, dressing them up like people, you know?
I hope.
Putting them in big coats. I mean, it sounds like a movie. This is like a Harry and the Henderson sequel.
Yeah, no joke.
But I think it's incredible. And it makes the whole Ape Canyon story that much better. Okay.
Yep. When you think about it in the sense that even in modern day, they're still there and the government is taking steps to protect the secrecy of these. I mean, I have thought for a while, Matt, and I don't know that I've said it on an episode before, but I've thought for a while that the government knows what Sasquatch is, at least sections of the government.
Yeah.
And they don't want to say anything because they know if they do, there's going to be some dang hillbilly, probably my cousin or something, get out there and try to find a Bigfoot scalp.
Yeah. Try to hunt one. Yeah.
Yep. So they know it's endangered, and the best way to keep this endangered creature safe, not even mention it. Pretend it doesn't
exactly
exist.
Exactly. But I just, you know, it just, you know, you and I, we have been asked, you know, in interviews and so forth, of all the things that you guys talk about, What is the one thing that you hope to find out is true? And I used to always say, you know, UFOs. I want to know if UFOs. Yep. But in light of what we have learned over the last year or two about UFOs and such, I've changed my answer. I want to know if this story is true.
Yeah.
From beginning to end, I want to know, is this the real story? Is this going to be the thing that tells us Bigfoot really did exist and our government helped rescue, you know, Bigfoot, Bigfoot off of Mount St. Helens? I got to know.
Yeah. And my answer has always been, I want Bigfoot to be real.
Adam has always said this, but I think we're going to get an answer on these UFOs. I am 100% convinced we're going to get an answer about this. It may not be the one we want, but I think we are going to get a definitive answer, you know, eventually and sooner than later. But I want to know, nobody's out there. You know, there's no congressional hearings about Bigfoot. But dadgummit, I think there ought to be.
Yep.
I mean, it's just this is fascinating. This is one of the best stories I've ever heard. I love it. But you know, as we say, what do you guys think? I mean, are you familiar with this legend? If you are from the Pacific Northwest, was this a story that you guys knew growing up? And if you knew the Ape Canyon story, did you know this about the government involvement after the Mount St. Helens eruption? I mean, you know, that all of that, it all comes together. And, you know, when you really do, when you boil it down and you go, where does Bigfoot come from? The Pacific Northwest is always the first place you talk about. So, you know, that's it. But let us know. Let us know what you think. The best place to do that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. Thousands of members in there. We love sharing these stories. You know, nobody's gonna call you a nut job or anything like that. We all just want to hear these really cool stories. So, you know, let us know what you think about this one. Don't forget to go check out our website. It's graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. And we thank you so much for the support that you've shown Adam and I over the years. It has really kept us going at times. So we always want to pause for a moment and thank those people that have donated to the show.
Absolutely.
Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It does help bring the show up in the search results. So it's just a way to get more people, you know, involved, which is what we want.
Right.
Whew, man, I loved it. I just can't get over it. I loved it. I got so excited doing this research.
I know, you know me and any bipedal hominid and something that comes into modern day this high profile, you know, it ties into, you know, the early origins of Bigfoot encounters, but then it's now, you know, modern day high profile being guarded supposedly by armed Air Force people. I love it.
It's the best. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.